here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week, we've got two. This is connected with a band titled The Children, who are veterans of such notable ensembles as The Swans and also Cop Shoot Cop. And they have a new album, a second album, that has just been released, A Sudden Craving, which is going to be available on vinyl and digital download. And I'm interviewing and chatting to two of the members, Jim Coleman and also Michael Wiener, to find out more about life, love, poetry and everything else. And they're in different places in America, but we managed to coordinate this beautifully. And Jim is the person who's going to be talking first from his car, which is even more exciting. So anyway, after several minutes of interesting but casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. Jim, it's over to you.
My musical awakening was when my parents took me to see Yellow Submarine, and I kind of immediately was opened into this kind of world of rock and psychedelia in a way, you know, and I was quite young, but that was transformative.
Yes, my God, I could imagine. That was, the Beatles were there slightly in the background with people like the Monkees and the Banana Splits for me. So, but those songs, songs that sort of stuck in your brain and were never going to ever get.
That's awesome.
It is. They're just perfect. And what about you, Michael? What was your kind of musical awakening?
You know, I can't say for sure, but oddly enough, I'm coming to some pop moments, like being in the living room for some reason, hearing my parents' copy of ABBA's Voulez-Vous was one. And I'm thinking about one of my first cassettes, which was Pat Benatar's Crimes of Passion, which actually holds up quite well, in my opinion. So those were a couple early ones. I'm thinking of things like the Police's Regatta de Blanc was an early cassette.
Yes.
that had a lot of resonance and has a lot of resonance for me to this day. So it wasn't super avant-garde I think it started in with a fairly sort of like the beauty of well-executed pop music that has a kind of a plangency to it that kind of reverberates internally or spiritually,
which yes.
was kind of what I was drawn to, I guess. And
absolutely.
Some of it happened to be disco-y or 70s-y or 80s-y or whatever, you know.
Well, it was perfect pop on both ABBA and The Police. And also, I sort of both had a certain drama and excitement. And obviously, you got Stuart Copeland's kind of amazing percussion, and then you got ABBA's incredible lyrical vocals and sort of songs, which were so steeped in romantic melancholia. You couldn't really go wrong with that, could you? So on both fronts, really. And I mean, sort of as then, you know, because just curious, Jim, because your musical world sort of is, you're a bit older than Michael, aren't you? So you've got more of a 70s period than him. So what was your kind of growing up phase and how did you start to sort of become part of a band?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's my musical studies or whatever started quite young. I was kind of forced to take classical piano, and I took classical piano for 8 years. And during that time, I kind of really wanted to just sit down at the piano and work out my own stuff. But I was always focused on, you know, classical studies. Halfway through that, I started taking French horn and took about 8 years of French horn lessons as well. I was taught by this older guy who had taught Dizzy Gillespie to play. And so whenever Dizzy Gillespie came into town, we'd go out and see him and hang out. And my dad was a big jazz head, so we went to a lot of jazz shows as well. My evolution into playing in a rock band went through making more experimental tape loop based stuff. I was a film student. I was taking like mag stripe of scuba diving documentaries and stuff like that, and making multi layered loops of different audio material, and then working on a four track. All that kind of stuff went into sampling, which kind of was pertinent to what I ended up doing with Cop Shoot Cop.
Yes, very exciting. So your 80s, just briefly, because I love the 80s. So how did your 80s shape up then? Where were you sort of living at this stage?
My 80s. So I moved into New York in probably 82.
Right.
while I was still in school, I was working down at the Collective for Living Cinema, an experimental film house in Tribeca. And I started going out to clubs every night, anywhere that I could dance for free, man. I'd go out and, you know, so I would be going around to, a bunch of clubs in New York that time.
Was it people like Danceteria and the Mud Club?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. That was an awesome period of time. It was New York was kind of dangerous and lawless, and there was no rules to really follow, you know?
Right.
So I loved that then.
I was going to say, were you a bit of a disco kid then as well? Did you say about dancing?
Well, I wasn't really. I know it's weird, right? I wasn't really a disco kid, but I loved dancing, and I loved the kind of just being out in social, you know, in that social environment.
Right, so. Blimey, alrighty. So, how did Cop Shoot Cop sort of develop at this stage?
So, Cop started as a three-piece with Todd, Phil, and Dave Wimay. Dave Wimay was just playing samples. He went on to form Motherhead Bug, which if, I don't know if you ever heard of them, but they were amazing. And Dave left to score some films for Troma Films, and Nats and I basically came in at the same time. I threw like a party at my apartment in Brooklyn, and I had Cop Shoot Cop play Unsane and another band, and that was right when Dave was leaving. So somehow on the heels of that, I was friends with at the time Todd's girlfriend, and she kind of knew what I was doing. And so there was this introduction, and after that party, he was like, "Hey, do you have any interest in joining?" And they were doing I'd been trying to get a band together, and they were doing exactly what I wanted to be doing. It was kind of a no-brainer to be like, "That's what I want to do." You know?
Yes, and it was quite an intense time, wasn't it? Your late 80s and early 90s. You had that classic five-year period, which a lot of bands have, don't they? The honeymoon period, then the single, the album, a couple of tours. Did you tour much with Cop Shoot Cop?
We toured a lot. I mean, for a few years, it seemed like we were on the road 9 months out of the year. And things definitely changed. You know, Nirvana opened up a lot, obviously, for a lot of different bands. There was a lot of money being thrown around to find the next Nirvana. And we benefited from that. And we were able to just make the music that we wanted to make and survive off it. I mean, we ended up, you know, incurring a sizable debt. Which ended up getting wiped out, but it was a gift to be able to just, you know, make the music we wanted to make and make a living off of it.
Yes, my God, you had two albums with Interscope Records, didn't you? At this stage, what was that like?
Yeah.
Going to a major at this point.
It was interesting. They were kind of hands off, which was good and bad. They were hands off. I mean, it was good that we could just do what we wanted. It was bad ultimately in that they weren't that invested in what we were doing. When we self-imploded, we were on the verge of going over to Nothing Records with Trent Reznor. But we kind of fell apart instead.
Yes, it does happen, isn't it? It's a tricky one, yes. And what about you, Michael? What was your, obviously you're a little bit younger than us, but was it your musical moments more in the 90s at this stage after your introduction to Abram, the First Police, Second
Police? Well, yeah, I mean, no, I mean, yes and no. I might be older than you think, but yeah, it's you know, I mean, Jim has just traced this whole, you know, this whole sort of very sort of long arc through of development. So I'll try to sort of synopsize mine, but I'll start with, I mean, Jim, it's kind of fun to hear because Jim and I, you know, we're close. We've collaborated for a long time. This has been a long germinating project, which is in some ways been, there's been frustrations about it, but then there's also been the opportunity to really like gather the moss and kind of have this sort of real nuance and real complexity to it that I think cannot be faked. There's a kind of a gravity to it that comes with a lot of time and a lot of sort of settling into place. But I too, as we just learned this in this interview process, that I also trained in classical and ragtime piano and so on when I was a kid. I had recitals. I did that whole bit. I then went on to violin. And then in adolescence, I kind of like, you know, as we kind of went through high school, I gradually kind of phased out on that. And you know, when Jim to a lesser degree, Phil, but when Jim and I met, we met with me being as a music critic, and I was writing about bands and for various magazines, in New York Paper Magazine, a bunch of other magazines, and I interviewed Cop Shoot Cop. I have it somewhere. I have the tear sheet. And, you know, we began a slow burn of a friendship that we'd see each other at shows and so on and so forth. So I was part of that whole 90s. Yeah, the 90s in particular, you know, is when I was in New York. And part of that whole scene, I was asked to sing for some bands and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, I was being a critic. And then I became trained as an actor. First, I was doing performance art, and I was doing solo sort of monologue, sort of Spalding Gray-esque type pieces where I was doing these monologues in theaters. And eventually trained as an actor and was working in theater, film, et cetera. But the music piece, I continued as a critic for a long time. And, you know, sang in some, there was moments in film and on stage where I sang. But Jim and I, the first time that really, really coalesced is when Jim and I decided to do The Children. And I was trying to talk about this last night because I did an interview without Jim. And I kind of forgot exactly. I was guessing that Jim might be able to corroborate this. I was guessing that we'd gotten to the point in our friendship where I was interested in, and I like what Jim had been doing all those years, you know, and I was interested in making music. So I probably instigated it, I would imagine, and said, you know, hey, Jim, we should try something. And then Jim was kind enough and open-minded enough to oblige. And we began to embark on this odyssey that really, in some ways, is just coming to fruition. As you know, and we started again. We've had it was funny because I was in an interview last night, and the interviewer had actually managed to track down our first album on YouTube. Do you know this, Jim? It was on YouTube. I hadn't seen it there, and it barely has any views. But you should really hear this. I feel like we should maybe reissue this, and maybe we'll get Chandra or someone else to do this. I mean, it's totally different. And in some ways, it's almost like embarrassingly obvious. But in other ways, it's kind of beautifully produced, and it's like kind of this art pop. It's like, it's really, given everybody's background in the downtown, kind of rugged and raw and primal and this and that. And at the time, I was doing some pretty wild performance stuff. It's fairly mellifluous. It sort of has this kind of lush quality to it. It's very different. It's very interesting to hear it. So, we'll, you know, if you want to, we can.
I'd love to sort of get a clip or yeah. Sort of. I have been Googling it, but frankly, that was someone did a very good job there. So, how did The Children, this project, you know, start? This was 15 plus years ago, wasn't it?
Exactly. So this is where we came into this record that I was just referring to, and we started by Jim and I doing this kind of process first to just the two of us. Jim could probably weigh in here, but first the two of us and doing these kind of improvisational things. And we got into a process, which I think still will work to this day when we finally sit down and you know, write something again, you know, where we get in the studio and it's just kind of, Jim is trying something and maybe Phil's trying something and kind of a groove builds and the groove happens and I start to improvise lyrics and blah, blah, blah. And we'd go through it a few times and the lyrics kind of form and form. And then finally we just stop and we put it down and we come back. And then I kind of refine the lyrics and, you know, and this is also, you know, I'm tackling a lot of your questions at once, but this also happened in the live process. One of our key earlier shows was a residency at a place called Monkey Town, which was this, originally started in a loft and then became a proper kind of restaurant and performance space where everyone sat on low lying couches in a kind of Japanese steakhouse style, giant screens behind them in a cube sort of setup. And there would be a video program and the band would be in residency in the middle. And so we had a kind of a rotating cast of performers from Mother Headbug and Cop and Swans and whatever who would cycle in and out. And we did a few days there. And I believe it informed a lot of our process. And then we went on to do, you know, theaters and boutiques and all kinds of non-traditional spaces and then eventually rock clubs. But again, this was the early work and it was very sporadic. And then we finally, in the mid to late teens, we did these two pivotal sessions where we wrote a number of songs that you hear today. And then the pandemic happened and everyone was geographically spread out, et cetera. But that gives you a quick synopsis.
Yes, my God, that's amazing. Yeah, so that was over 15. So at that stage, Jim, obviously Cop Shoot Cop had finished. What were you doing with your career and life at this stage?
So after Cop imploded, I did some kind of electronic stuff as Phyler, like Phylr. I had a couple releases out as that. I did a collaboration with Teo Tiardo in Italy called Here. And, you know, did a bunch of soundtracks for indie feature films and then television. I ultimately moved away from pursuing that in terms of it just being such a committee, you know. It was kind of like taking this thing I loved, making music, and twisting it into this, you know, work for hire. Sometimes I still do that. It depends on what the film might be. I enjoy it, but I didn't want to be dependent on it. Mm-hmm. So I've continued to make music. I think that was what I was doing when Michael and I started this. Since then, I've done a couple of ambient records. I'm in the middle of recording mixing now. We just started mixing with Human Impact, which is more like it's kind of a noise rock, you know, somewhat from the 90s. I mean, it's kind of got that. It's with Chris Spencer from Unsane. And so it's got that kind of aesthetic to it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And just going to the 90s, it was kind of an interesting decade. It started with, you know, like the Seattle grunge scene and people like Kurt Cobain. It finishes in kind of Woodstock 99 with all these kind of rap metal gangs, you know, boy bands who were destroying the place. How was it for you kind of as a creative artist seeing what was coming of your kind of world and culture and trade? I mean, not trade, but, you know, it was a bit strange, wasn't it? You know, you suddenly had Limp Bizkit, you had all these, you know, metal rapping guys who just wanted to smash stuff up and, you know, wake up every morning being angry. What was it like for you sort of, obviously you weren't at Woodstock 99, which probably was a good thing, but, you know, at the same time, it was a very strange decade and it started quite innocently and ended in such a sort of violent but brattish manner.
So, I mean, I understand the emotion. Like, when we had Cops You Cop, it was, you know, fueled by this kind of anger and discontent. And you know, that's relevant today in the music I'm doing with Human Impact. And given what the socio-political climate is, it's valid, I think, you know, the sense of outrage. Anyway, that was relevant then. It's relevant now. But I feel like what happened with like Limp Bizkit and Korn and all that was this commodification and commercialization of that. You know, it kind of packaged it up and sold it, you know. It was a strange, it also took a lot of nuance out of it. You know, I feel like ultimately, if it's just about that, it's pretty monochromatic, you know, and it's not a very human experience, if that makes
sense. Yes. Well, I think with a lot of youth culture, there's often, from whether it's the 60s, even the punk period, well, definitely the punk period, there was a sense of something that you were angry about for a good reason, whereas the Woodstock 99 generation seemed to be having it pretty good and weren't really... They were angry, obviously, because they wanted to smash it up, but there was no reason for what they were doing because they were having quite a good period in their kind of the teen years, wasn't it? They were almost irrelevant in what they were had become because there was nothing to fight against.
Maybe. I mean, it's funny. We're at a point now where, you know, we can look back and kind of like have this fondness and miss like the Bush Cheney era, you know, in the U.S. And partly I'm kidding, but partly I'm not. It's like, you know, I remember that was outrageous then, what was happening politically. And now it's kind of, you know, you miss the normalcy of that. So,
Yes, I remember when Reagan got in, we thought, oh, that's outrageous. And now you think, God, he's quite a good politician. But, you know, at the
but
time...
You know, the thing... But I think partly what we're talking about, though, is in fact nostalgia. We're talking about the refracted nature of memory and the refracted nature of experience. Yes, obviously there are some unpleasant and corrosive aspects to the state of spiritual state of society at the moment. At the root of it is something that's also given us some benefit, which is of course things like multimedia and things like the internet and so on and so forth. The 24-hour sort of access and this kind of thing has kind of amplified the discourse in such a way people are looking in a mirror all the time. It's sort of like this distorted Warholian sort of miasma in a way, right? But I think that partly we do look back at times and we are able to find the fondness. And I think part of the goal here is, which I think we also try to do with our music, is to be present, to be in the moment, to sort of turn your face toward the darkness and maybe find the light there as well. So I think that's part of what this record is trying to do, if I might just bring it to the record a little bit and say, you know, I think that we can do better at being present with each other. And it starts with the dialogue like this, where we're present listening to each other. And we can refract, we can change the lens through which we see the world, and it can impact how we see the world and, in fact, what happens in the world, in my opinion. So just to inject a little optimism, I don't want to, I'm not a big jump off the cliff, or I'd love to see, I feel the darkness, but I'd love to find ways to see the light in that as well. So I think some of that is just looking backward and you think, oh yeah, it was so rosy. These kids had things to be angry about because they're kids, because they're, you know, there's primal stuff bubbling up, and I guess they were a little entitled or whatever it was, but like, you know, they had an excuse to be angry. It was just might be different than maybe somebody today, but there's a reason to be angry in adolescence or when you're 19 or whatever it is, you know? So I think that, you know, we can't just say the macrocosm of the culture, oh, they had no reason to be angry. I think that there was probably a reason. It was just like individualized, you know what I mean? And they have no right to go rape some girl or something, but like they, you know, like the anger itself is, they just need to learn to channel it better, you know, and something, you know, I don't know, just to...
No, it's a good point, and it's easy to going completely off. But I know this week I just seen on certain posts, you know, like which are punk posts or sort of, but you know, about era, you know, a previous era, people talk about Taylor Swift and oh my God, her music's terrible. But I think, well, actually, what she's doing is amazing, and I think she's an amazing artist. And just remembering what the Clash were like, or the Sex Pistols, and pretending Johnny Rotten and Joe Strummer are incredible, you know, writers and performers. It's like, well, actually, Taylor Swift is the same. You know, you could say the same. I mean, musically, those two bands aren't that much different, really. I mean, you know, the Sex Pistols are basically the Monkees meets the Stooges. You know, you can't say, wow, that's something completely avant-garde, can you? So anyway, I agree about the nostalgia thing. I think nostalgia is a bit tricky. When you hear a person your own age knocking what young people are listening to, you always feel a bit embarrassed because, you know, you just think, God, listen to yourself, mate. You do sound like an old man. But anyway, so get into... Sorry.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
anyway, so when did you then, after your first album, which is impossible to find apart from on YouTube, when did you come together again to think, let's do another project, Mark II? Jim?
I mean, yeah, go ahead.
No, Michael, go for it. I'm trying to remember.
Well, I mean, I don't think we ever left. I think that the issue here is when we made the record. We had been trying to get somebody to, you know, in other words, we did all these shows. I think people downtown were interested and knew about us and were excited. Hope we play more often and blah, blah, blah. We were never able to achieve the momentum due to various, you know, things going on in people's lives with relationships or geography or any or other band projects that were high profile or whatever it was. Jim had, you know, Jim's production work, different things. It just happened that I mean, what made this record happen is really like a kind of a convergence at Phil's wedding during the pandemic at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. And we just had a great group of people there. And one of them was Chandra. And Chandra spoke of having, you know, of liking the children. And it basically just sort of planted the seed for us to pull this record together. You know, we haven't rehearsed or done anything yet, right? We've just taken the material that we recorded in the mid to late teens. From my understanding, and because I did just look at the lyric sheet and saw a couple of the lyrics from the 2017 that we did use a few of those songs, so I could share that with you at some point. But anyway, we took those sessions, and then I guess Jim had met with in 18 or 19, you had a BZ session that I wasn't at, and they refined some of the, you know, we had some other players with Norman from Swans and a clarinetist named Johnny Gasper, and we. This was an opportunity for us to gather this material. Jim and I were just kind of joking around the other day about archiving, and we've got stuff that we need to dig up from some of these sessions, and we've got all kinds of things that we want to do. So we still have material that we can harness. You know, I'm of course, you know, hopefully we're going to get together and write some more soon, but like, this is all kind of like a product. It's kind of what I was trying to say at the beginning. This kind of miraculous German, you know, 15-year germination period where we're just gradually coming together and having this opportunity to put this out. So to me, it's this big blessing and miracle, and Jim, I'm sure you can add to that.
Yes. Did you say BC as in Martin BC, or was that?
Yes, with Martin BC. Yeah.
Oh.
We did some of the recording was done there as well.
The BC Studios. Excellent, actually. Yeah. So yes. So this is material that you were doing in the sort of the late teen period.
Yeah, mid to late teens. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. The album covers music that we, you know, created through a number of years. It was kind of a span. And I think as a result, there's some, you know, variances in production and recording that you can hear. That's part of its charm, I think.
Yes, there's a lot of, so going through some of the tracks, it's been quite interesting to listen to it. There's fascinating sort of a different styles throughout. There's no cohesive kind of narrative, is there? There's like quite a lot of going from sort of, there's an acoustic guitar with your vocals. There's a kind of very gothic kind of Dead Can Dance moment. There's a track called Guiding Your Age Her Way. That's kind of a fascinating song with a fantastic kind of gothic saxophone going. So can you kind of remember how this song came about? Or was that a long
time? Well, there's the music and then there's the lyrics. So, I don't even know if I can speak to I'll let Michael speak to lyrics. But, I mean, I think, like, one thing I really enjoy about the album in general is that it's far reaching in terms of instrumentation and songwriting, you know. It's inclusive in terms of a lot of different musicians, but even like the musicians that were playing, like say like Phil is, you know, typically known for his drumming. He was playing a lot of different wind instruments and percussive instruments, but you know, he was doing playing a lot of instruments that he doesn't usually play. I was also playing, you know, French horn and hurdy-gurdy and a lot of instruments that I don't typically play, but love experimenting with. So I think there's an experimental approach to instrumentation, recording processes, and even who's involved in it. And maybe Michael can speak to the lyrical content of that.
Yes. So how did you develop your lyrics? Did you sort of bring them to the music, or did you sort of listen to the music and then sort of add them, or were you sort of working with an instrument? Because there's a couple where there's an acoustic guitar and just your vocals.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this before. I'm trying to actually look at the lyrics. My computer has this like break in the middle. It's got like this weird black bar in the middle of the screen. I have to go get it fixed, and I have to kind of like, I have to like circle around the screen to see you guys. We have a very organic recording songwriting process. We're like I said, I mean, it often starts with me and Jim and then Phil as well at points. And you know, it's just about playing in the studio and finding these kind of like, just kind of jamming and finding these moments, and you find a groove, you find a chord, you find a riff, you kind of come back and you keep playing and you kind of come back and back and back and kind of create this sort of, you know, we're getting into a rhythm with it. And I just start improvising lyrics, you know, and then go through it. And I we've gone through it, you know, maybe we're going through it for about 10, 15 minutes or whatever it is, 20 minutes. And then we stop and we just kind of look at it. And then I kind of sit there and scrawl and kind of refine the lyrics a bit. And then we come back in, we do it again. And then even during the recording process, there may be some adjustment as well. But it's really kind of a very organic process that most often, occasionally Jim will give me something to look at, and I'll do it and start it at home. I'm just listening to it and writing. But it's sort of the same idea, but not live.
Yes.
Much of this it begins as a very improvisatory exercise, and then it becomes, and then it gets shaped and molded, you know? So that's, if that helps sort of explain the process a little bit.
There's a connection there also to the way we've approached some of our shows, which is kind of a mix of, you know, including some songs that have been, you know, predefined, and then also more of a open-ended improv, you know, improv-based. We have these sections that are more improv based as well.
Yes. And were you sometimes just more interested in the voice as an instrument rather than worrying too much about the lyrical content? Because the vocals can sometimes sort of become very expressive on some of those tracks as well, and sort of hitting those high notes or just working with the rhythm, or sometimes with the guitar. So does it sort of alter depending on the musical kind of soundscape that goes with it? Michael.
Oh, you're asking me.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't sure. So you're asking me if I alter the vocals themselves in terms of instrumentation?
Well, are sometimes some of the songs, are they more with the, when there's certain, you know, where you're playing with the voice, is that more important, a bit like Liz Fraser with the Cocteau Twins, is that more the focus than worrying too much about the lyrics and just sort of enjoying the repetition of certain sounds that you've created on it?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about doing these interviews is getting, you know, bright, thoughtful people who kind of bring another vantage point to what we're doing and kind of allow us to think about it in another way. So if you'd asked me if I'd thought about that process that way, I wouldn't say necessarily that's the case. But now that you bring it up, you know, Jim and I, yeah, there's a lot of intuitive interplay and dialogue happening. And I think there's a lot of encouragement to explore. And then Jim, you know, is great producer and kind of, you know, carves it and so on. But like, I think that's true. I think that there is times, I mean, listen, the lyrics are very important, and they're, as you can see, they're not always linear. They're not, there's not always a clear narrative. I would maybe argue with when you say that there wasn't a cohesive theme to the record. I don't know if I could depict exactly what that theme is, but we do have a record called A Sudden Craving by a band called The Children. And I think that that partly is about following our impulses, you know, letting, you know, living with abandon, not being afraid of what we find inside, even as we lose the innocence that we had as children, but instead facing, and we talked about this earlier about the culture, facing that darkness, finding that's a path towards the light. And so it's sort of about, I think it's about casting away guilt and shame and living with who you are and kind of embracing it and kind of wallowing in it in a certain way. Some of this music has a certain wallowing quality, I think. And it's just about kind of enveloping and immersing. And, you know, we want to make people think and provoke people and in our both in the recording and in our shows, and kind of rip open the envelope a little bit and have a communal sharing of something very raw, you know? So I think that to your point though, I think that the voice can be, there's room for that I get room to explore my vocals in these songs. And again, the lyrics can be a bit abstract or a bit jagged or sort of fractured, but they do seem to, that there is something happening in that narrative. It just might be a little more oblique than you might normally hear in songwriting. You know, dare I compare myself in some ways to Cobain in terms of like the raw poetry? Maybe there's a little bit of that, you know? But it's not, it's interesting. It's not obvious. And if I look at the songs we wrote for the first album, which I'm sure you'll hear at some point, or hope you'll hear at some point, they're more obvious, and this is a bit more inscrutable, a little more abstract. And again, like with the vocals too, less emphasis on art pop and more emphasis on kind of tearing the envelope open a little bit and seeing what's inside. And as a result, I think we get to see something a little more subtle and nuanced.
Yes.
If that answers your question.
Yeah. Cause I think, was it the last track, Smothered My Traces? That's got a very, it's a very closing song, isn't it? Because it's a very ambient sort of feel to it, as if there's as if we've been on a journey of some feeling of kind of emotional state, and it's kind of, this is the last song. Did you spend a long time sort of working out the track listing for the album?
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely a number of iterations before we landed on that particular list. It seems like, it's funny, all right. We're in the period of time where a lot of people don't listen to albums. I still take it really seriously, and I guess if people are buying vinyl, mm-hmm. yeah, they'll probably listen to a side. But generally speaking, people are really listening to like one song or something like that. That being said, I still really enjoy sequencing an album and mapping that journey.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it was interesting because I remember growing up to the David Bowie Low album, which has a sort of a lot of sonic quality, especially side two, and also the work of Jarbo as well. Are you sort of also curious what other people are sort of doing at the moment, sort of like people, you know, like Jarbo, who was in the Swans as well?
What is Jarbo doing? I was actually wondering that the other day.
she toured last year. She came to the UK and did some dates in Belgium and, you know, sort of did a collaboration with some chap as well. So, yes, I did an interview with her, and it all sounded very dense and curious. And,
I was just listening to some of that, the Swan stuff that she was involved in. I mean, she can be very amazing. Sorry, I lost track of the original question, but go ahead.
No, I was just kind of curious what you were thinking about hearing other members of your, say, generation and what they're doing now, because I've done quite a few interviews with people like from Enstrotzen Neubarten, which I always mispronounce, but they're all doing sort of quite curious and interesting sort of solo work as well, which has a sort of a spiritual density to it. And I just wondered if this is something that as we hit, some of us hit in our late 50s and 60s, are sort of going culturally and spiritually into a different dimension.
Michael, you want to go first and then I'll jump in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll just add that, like, I think, you know, I'm sure I could speak for Jim on this as well. You know, we're very supportive of other artists and very omnivorous in our tastes and really try to be kind of, you know, to a fault, like really tapped into everything that's going on, because it's just interesting to be in dialogue. That being said, if I may say so, one thing that I really love is I think that we've absorbed some of it unconsciously, and I think there's a lot of osmosis and intuition in the music. I don't think that we're definitely trying for anything in particular. It seems to be pretty unique and not, I haven't really heard anything quite like it. Not that I can really hear it objectively at this moment, but like, you know, it's sort of like I need a little distance probably. But, you know, it's funny, you brought up Low, and, I think that when I'm trying to describe it in shorthand to people who aren't quite as sort of avant-garde, I'll talk about, you know, the experimental side of David Bowie. That'll give you a sense of what we're doing. You know, like I sometimes use that as a shorthand. So it's funny that you brought Low up, you know, because I feel like that's sort of an easy way to describe the people who don't really listen to, really underground stuff. I'm interested in everything that's going on. I don't necessarily bring it into a room. I don't know how I bring it in, because we kind of just go with the moment. And I think that the new stuff is, I can't really call it new anymore, but the later material that we've written, recent years, is a lot more frequency than the earlier stuff, which you'll hear when you hear the earlier stuff, at some point.
And I was curious, because I saw your press release and your drummer and multi-instrumentalist Phil. He also did the soundtrack to this film called Rima Rima. Did you see the film Rima Rima by any chance? Because it's kind of just there.
Yeah, I've not seen it. The same filmmaker did the documentary on the Swans. What is the name of that film? I forget offhand.
Yeah, Marco Porcia.
Yes, that's the director. Yeah, yes, yeah. I haven't seen that one, but I've seen the Rima Rima one.
What did you think of that?
I was stunned, because it was a project that only lasted 8 months, and it had various people in it, like Marco Peroni, who went on to be Adam and the Ants, kind of his guitarist and songwriter, and worked with people like Sinead O'Connor and also Dorothy Max Pryor on drums and various other people who all became part of that 4AD label. I mean, that was the first release on 4AD Records, was Rima Rima single.
Oh, interesting.
And it was just a fascinating... a bit of kind of archaeology, really. They did this one EP, people sort of loved it and then became curious with it. And it starts with a guy who makes perfume, and he has this condition that means that he can, when he hears music, he's got, I think it's called synesthesia, where he kind of then creates a perfume from it. And so now he's got a whole line of perfumes that are based on certain music from avant-garde bands from mostly England and Germany. So you never know, he might listen to one of your songs and create a perfume. And then when I saw your press release, I thought, God, Rima Rima, that's very niche, isn't it? So I just wondered if you had seen
that's
it.
Wonderful.
Yes.
I saw the trailer, but not the movie. Yeah.
It had all our favorites on, really. So with working with other people, because it's mostly, is it the two of you, this project, that bring in people to add their bit to it, or how does it sort of work on that level?
So we're the kind of founding members. Phil, who's a drummer, percussionist, he was also drummer in Cop Shoe Cop and is now drumming with Swans for many, many years. He's a, you know, kind of a quintessential part of what we're doing as well. And, you know, there's been a variety of other people who have added a lot to it. Kirsten McCord is a cellist who is, you know, well represented on the record and made significant contributions. And Rock Savage and John Nolan, who are the rhythm section from Bark Market. I don't know if you know them from back in the day. They've done a lot. Norman, guitarist from Swans, or was from Swans. He's got some stuff on there. That's just kind of naming a few.
In a dream world, be able to sort of really get together in a residential place for a few weeks, months, and sort of really pull things together? Or is it the case that nowadays people have to work much more individually, sending files to each other?
Well, you know, what we were doing in making this record, we had, like, for a large part of it, Phil and Michael and I were together in upstate New York in a artist studio, and we made the foundations of a lot of tracks. There was another session where it was John and Rock, and I can't remember if Phil was there as well, and Michael in more of a recording studio. But then from there, I would go into different places. We did some recording at Martin BC's. I'd go in, like, recording with Kirsten. I did a lot of that in her apartment, you know? So, like, it was kind of going to all these different locations to record individuals. Yeah, I mean, getting together in kind of a creative residency where all those people could be together and we can have a larger group of people to kind of create something. Sure, that'd be a dream, you know? Would love to do that.
Yes, I just wondered what the outcome would be. And you mentioned that at the beginning-ish, one of my favourite instruments, the hurdy-gurdy. How did you discover, or how did you find the hurdy-gurdy in your life? How did that sort of appear?
Well, I've always loved the sound of that, the drones, the doubled notes. It's just such a wonderful, consuming sound. And I remember, like, a couple shows we did actually in the UK with Cop Shoe Cop, and we opened... We had like a duo open hurdy-gurdy and vocals, and it was wonderful, and it was such a contrast to what we were doing sonically, and the audience was very confused and kind of upset, you know. But for us, it made total sense. Years later, I was like, you know what? I really wanted a hurdy-gurdy. I found somebody in the Pacific Northwest who makes hurdy-gurdies. I remember calling him up on the phone, and he was in the middle of, like, the forest, like, finding wood, locating trees to, like, cut down and make hurdy-gurdies. So I got a hurdy-gurdy, having no idea how to play it. And I still, like, kind of just mess around with it, but just the tones you can get with it are astonishing.
Yeah, so it's in the UK, because there was a folk band called Blowsabella, and there was a guy called Nigel Eaton in it. And then he developed a duo with Paul James called Ancient Beatbox, and it had his kind of wind instruments and his kind of this droning music. And bizarrely, he got pulled on tour with Jimmy Page and Robert Plant in the 90s, who would just happen to look for a hurdy-gurdy player, and they just got in touch with him and said, do you want to tour the world with us? And he said, well, probably that would be a good idea. So it's one of those instruments I do love that quality and that kind of rhythm and that kind of pace and that depth that comes with the hurdy-gurdy. I think it adds such a lot. So I do love those kind of slightly ancient gothic kind of, I think with a lot of music, and I did sort of feel that with you, this album, there's a kind of a depth that goes back to a different period that you can get sometimes with certain instrumentation and a sonic quality that, you know, when you listen to a lot of 80s production, you know, that sounds so like, oh God, that's a bit, you know, that's not great, is it? But when you hear something a bit older, it's quite amazing. And I love my sweeping statements. But
no, thank you. That's kind of like means a lot to hear that. I haven't really heard that phrased in that way or kind of focused in that way. I agree with you completely. I think that there's kind of an ancient quality to the record.
Yes.
It's really nice to hear that. So thanks.
We did love, you know, I'm not sure if you came across them, but Dead Can Dance in the 80s and then the 90s was one of our...
Sure, love them.
So I did, it was a couple of times I went, oh God, I must go and check that, get my albums back, you know, and have a good listen. Because that's quite, it's nice when you hear it one album now and then it kind of reminds you of something from the past and you think, oh yeah, I think only a few guys have heard Dead Can Dance as well. There you go.
Oh yeah. Awesome.
Oh, well, look, this has been brilliant. Well, I have to say, it's been one of those albums I've loved working through, and then sort of, and you know, and like you, actually, I sometimes have a weird way of starting at the end and then going backwards. I always think, I know what they put on at the last song. It kind of tells a lot about a record, actually. How much care did someone put into this? If they just went, you know, and then you listen to that as well as the first, because the first one's often the kind of, okay, that's the one that's going to be catchy. But I want to hear what the last song is. What did they think was going to go in at the end? And sometimes it can be just the best because they're like, yeah. And also because yours has got this ambient quality and it feels a lovely kind of way to finish the narrative, actually. So, yeah. Well, I hope you get to play live and be amazing if you get to do some more albums soon. Well, another album anyway.
So. Yeah, yeah.
So just brief, just last thing. If you could have just whispered something like your 16-year-old self, you know, starting out, is there anything that you would have just whispered to them, you know, even if that person might have ignored them? Jim?
Don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs. That's a good one.
No, I'm kidding. Of course, I like go to the kind of sarcastic part of it. But, you know, I feel like... I feel like in a way I'm like at this age discovering who I genuinely was at 16, say, right? And so I think through my earlier life, I put on a lot of like coats of identity and like, you know, kind of seeming protection that kept me at a distance from the world. And partly through aging and other spiritual work, I guess, you know, I'm at a point where I can like finally live my genuine truth, right? And that definitely wasn't the case when I was 16. When I was 16, I had defenses and walls up to protect myself, and they might have been necessary at that age, right? But they carried on well after they were necessary until they became a liability. So I'm happy. It's odd. I'm happy to be the age I'm at because I feel freer than I've ever felt before, if that makes sense.
Do you feel lighter?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yes, yeah. Quite. What about you, Michael? What's your kind of...
Yeah, I think I would say something similar. I would say... You're a good guy. Breathe, relax. You know, don't have to try so hard. Just, and I think, you know, as Jim says, I mean, part of like I said, you know, just part of what we do and part of what makes the collaboration so rewarding is this willingness as men, as guys in the middle of life, you know, to peel back the layers and really look at the find strength in the rawness and the vulnerability beneath. And I think that's really a privilege to be able to sit here and sort of examine it and think about it and reflect on it and have somebody else give us a little perspective and feedback on what we're doing. And it's also just a pleasure to sit with Jim and, you know, and Phil too, when he's here, and just commune and reflect on what it is to exist, what it is to be a man, what it is to evolve, you know? And I think this is music is really about evolution, and we're hoping to convey that and touch people, you know? So I think, yeah, it really, you're right. It does start at that fraught moment, you know? And then we put the pieces back. We peel the layers and we put the pieces back together and we see that it was there all along, but we needed a little time to come to an understanding of who we are. You know?
Yes, the journey is a fascinating thing. I think if we swap our expectations for appreciation, life would feel like a miracle, really, really. Because then, you know, every day would be like, oh, I'm grateful for that, rather than looking for the things that are irritating. But anyway, well, look, thank you ever so much for your time, and amazing to have a catch up, and I will keep in touch with Howard. But yeah, and loved the album, just thought it was really beautiful. So it's been great to have a listen.
Thank you so much, David.
And hear a whole new sort of soundtrack. So, But anyway, have a lovely day. And thanks for your time again. It's been amazing.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Great to meet you, David.
Okay, really take care. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that, dear listener, is the end of the interview. You probably gathered that. Anyway, that was... two of the members of the band The Children, who's got a new album, A Sudden Craving, out and about, and that was with Jim Coleman and also with Michael Wiener. Thank you ever so much for giving me the time for that interview. And also, this is C86 Show. If you want to contact me, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just do C86 Show. And also, all these interviews have been archived on Spotify, iTunes, Podbeam. It's true. Have a great week. Stay safe.